Hi, everyone. Carl here. I find the premise for this episode of Spiral Marketing to be fascinating and surprising in how it came together. One day, I got a random email with a proposal for the show. Now, just about every podcast gets pitched by speakers interested in being a guest. That's not what's noteworthy, and that's actually not what really happened here, but the email I got was from the head of a communications agency asking if I might like to have one of his clients on the show. Now, from a marketing perspective, this struck a chord with me. And in speaking with this communications agency, I found the story behind the development of an outreach campaign to a new media outlet on behalf of startups to be particularly intriguing. As well, the man behind the idea had a great story to tell. So I asked him to be on the show. What stood out for me was this kind of stitchwork of how the media landscape changed behind his story. And I believe that there are wonderful lessons in here about navigating change, pursuing your interests, and thinking outside of the box to provide value. I hope you enjoy.
What is the DNA of business marketing? How do we market ourselves now and in the future? Brand communications is evolving. Are you? Let's explore together. Spiral upwards. This is Spiral Marketing.
Lee Schneider is the founder of Red Cup Agency. Red Cup is a communications agency that builds networks of users, customers, and influence around entrepreneurial ventures and startups. The company specializes in growing network contacts by working at the intersection of social media, traditional PR, and advertising. Red Cup manages data-driven business intelligence projects, advertising campaigns on Facebook, as well as advertising campaigns on Twitter. Welcome, Lee.
Thanks so much. That's a good introduction, but of course I wrote it myself, so it sounds sounds all right, doesn't it?
I thought so. And you know, you've got a nice long bio here, and for what it's worth, I was very impressed. Also, you and I have a lot of things that are in common that are a bit unusual. For example, you're in Santa Monica, you're in Los Angeles, and right when you were starting your business, I was getting out of my previous consultancy right around that area. So it's interesting. I closed a chapter there right as you were starting a chapter, but the startup culture that I think really started to blossom around 2009 when I left, you've continued that path, and it seems like you've done quite a lot in there. For example, you've written a book related to startups, and you do a fair amount of work with startups. So I think you have a unique perspective on what's new in the communications world. As they say, as goes Los Angeles, so goes the world, right?
Yes, perhaps so. I was reading a New York Times piece about policing from the air. This sounds like it's going to be a tangent, but it's not. And they're talking about LA being a model for future cities because they can be policed better by helicopter than on the ground. So LA, for better or worse, does give you a view of the future.
That's interesting. Yeah, it seems like that's been the case for since the beginning of the 1900s.
Yeah, right.
First, if you don't mind, since we do have such an rather unusual backstory, I thought it'd be interesting to hear how you heard about the Spiral Marketing podcast.
Sure. A lot of what we do is based on research, as you read in that little introduction. So I found myself deeply invested in a lot of data dives into networks. If we're building networks for people, we have to know what those networks are and who's in them. So we use a lot of tools to build those. Sometimes we will use something called follower wonk, which is all these things have silly names, I apologize in advance, but which is a service of Moz, M-O-Z, and it allows you to look at people's Twitter followers and get an idea of who, it pulls them out, right? So you can actually see who they're following. We use a tool called Mention, which listens to keywords and things like that. It's kind of like a super duper Google Analytics. But for the podcast search, I decided that it would be good for more of my clients to be on podcasts because they're a great medium. It's a bit quasi-long form, which is better than blippy. You really get to meet someone and know someone. So I really just started crunching into LinkedIn and just searching LinkedIn for the keyword podcast producer or podcast booker. And I ended up with a list of 400 or so people, which I sorted through. And then, you know, me and Kate DeRocher, who does outreach for us, we both were just emailing people. And sometimes good old-fashioned email works really well because it's not as distractible. You don't get sidetracked as often. And it's pretty personal. You know, it's a direct inbox kind of a thing. They do get ignored a lot. But if you can write an interesting subject line, which is really what it's all about, kind of like the headline, people will read it. And then, you know, you were one of the people who responded. We had a pretty amazingly good response rate for just emailing people out of the blue, you know, which, as you can imagine, is pretty hard to do.
Right. Right. Well, I think podcasters tend to be a rather friendly and open bunch.
Mm-hmm. And they're opinionated about their podcast. So I must say, in the interest of transparency, I got a lot of, who are you? How dare you email me emails? And I also got some very friendly emails like, great, let's talk. And we ended up booking a number of people on podcasts and also ended up saying to others, well, we'll get back in touch when we have someone more appropriate for you. So it's a spectrum, which is something that I wouldn't call it hit or miss, but you know, you have to be open to lots of possibilities with this kind of outreach. Not everything is going to connect. Even if you research diligently, the timing could be wrong to connect with someone. So you just kind of have to go with a little bit.
Sure. And I really appreciate your spirit of experimentation there. You know, you mentioned the tools that you use. And of course, we'll get all of that linked up in the show notes. But one of my favorite parts of that story in going through your process was that at the end of the day, you ended up with a list that you effectively manually put together and manually emailed. And I'm sure you could have used some kind of automation system. And even if you did, it doesn't matter because you had to manually do these things and think outside of the box and just put it together and do it.
Right. I do use automated email systems sometimes. We use MailChimp, we use Emma, and we use something called Reply App. But the secondary email is always from me or from Kate. If it goes on too long as an automated thing, people catch on to that. And I also think it's a little bit strange. But when you're dealing with, like I sent out a press advisory this morning, which was to 40 people or so. And that first email is, it's customized, but it's basically a send to a medium to small group of people. If I know people and I've been emailing them a lot, I won't do that. But if I don't know them at all and it's an initial outreach, I think an automated or semi-automated approach is totally okay.
Agreed. Agreed. As long as people don't feel like they're immediately being put on a list as your first touch point, then at least you have a chance of building a relationship, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And also, most of the time, in fact, there should be always an unsubscribe link so people can see, oh, wait a minute, this is not a personal email. I think it's also, you have to do that by law, but I think it's also fair. The big no-no, which I guess we shouldn't get into yet, but we will anyway, because I started the sentence, is, you know, just kind of beating away at people and being kind of a mindless marketing robot is annoying. And people sort of spoil the batch for everybody by just hammering away. And then I find myself saying, can you please take me off your list? Which is sort of like the last resort. You don't want some guy like me saying that to you. That's not good.
Understood. I can appreciate all of that. Well, do you consider your company to be a new generation of a communications agency?
Yes, because I'm always not only experimenting, but trying to work at a kind of a fuzzy intersection. When people ask me what I do, it takes, you know, as we say, I don't really have an elevator pitch. I have more of an escalator pitch. It's a little slower, but you do get where you're going.
I like that.
I work at the intersection of several disciplines deliberately and mix them up a bit deliberately. So yes, I find that we have to reinvent this a lot, and it's a moving target a lot. So it's not something that we can replicate perfectly. Of course, the smart thing about any business is you get to replicate something, a replicatable process. We have that and we don't have that. You know, I'm always aiming toward process, but it doesn't always show up for me because the situation is different every time.
Sure. Well, what's keeping you inspired about running this new kind of communications agency?
It really is just that, the ever-changing nature of it. You know, when I worked in television news, there was always adrenaline. Even when working in long-form documentaries, there was always adrenaline because you had to finish something by a certain amount of time. It either had to go up on the air tonight, or it had to be ready next week, or whatever it was. So you always had a charge. I was never bored, but it did have patterns. You know, you planned something, you went into pre-production, you went into production, you did some editing, you did some post-production, looped in the music, the narration, whatever it might be, right? There was a pattern there, which for a decade was comforting. But then it becomes, well, do I just have to replicate this process again and again and again? And what I find about this is that there is a process, of course, but working with startups and early stage businesses, there's always something new to understand, always a new market, always a new connection to be made, always new networks to be built, right? So I find it stimulating in that way because it's a problem solving kind of a thing where I get to apply what I know, but there's also a lot that I don't know. Don't tell my clients that, but you know, the idea of the unknown is pretty scary to people, but I find it pretty interesting.
Right. Yeah, I can identify with that. Often when people ask me why I went into marketing, I say, well, you know, at first I got to use both sides of my brain. You get to be strategic and you get to be creative. And at a pretty high level, that's hard to find in most businesses.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, people like to go, oh, we're a data business. You know, we're all intellectuals. We're all, and other people say, oh, we're all completely creative and we only do, you know, drawings and ideas and things like that. But nowadays, I think business really overlaps. Both sides of the brain are important. Since we're all kind of atomized free agents marketing ourselves now or helping others do it, and since we're all kind of building our own networks independently, it requires that dual side of the brain thing, or you're kind of in trouble.
Right. Yeah, I agree. If you want to solve the problem, you really have to use both. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned journalism and TV production. That's a good segue. I wanted to ask you, how did your past lead you into this new world of communications?
Well, I had been writing, producing, directing for 16 years or so in local television, news magazines like Dateline NBC, and ran a production company and ran production for other companies in Travel Channel, History Channel, Bravo, The Learning Channel, lots of them, you know, and it was great for a long time. I really enjoyed the stimulus of new ideas. You know, the wonderful thing about being a journalist is that you have to become an expert on something. And you don't always get to do the same thing over and over, which is good. You get to become an expert on something new. And so I was doing predominantly science and history and engineering kind of documentaries and got to learn a lot about that world and how to interview people in that world, which was a lot of fun. But then from a business standpoint, as I was running it as a business, not only did I become kind of that kind of repeating the same thing over and over thing was starting to happen, but the margins were getting smaller and smaller and smaller, which, you know, in a production standpoint means the network wanted more and more and more, and they were paying less and less and less. And I was a one-off guy doing specials and short flight series. I wasn't a major series guy. You know, that's not what my company did. So the major series people had a lot of slop. You know, they could make room. Like if one episode cost a lot, they could steal it from another episode. But I didn't have that kind of leverage. So it meant changing. You know, it meant, 2009, 2010, the date you mentioned before. It meant, okay, we have to change this because I don't want to keep doing it the way I'm doing it. And I saw a lot of my friends also losing their jobs, you know, because of the economy and because of the way media was going, was becoming devalued and also more automated in some ways. They needed fewer people. They needed fewer high level people. They could make do with lots of smart but young people. So that was not a great environment for me. So I changed. I decided, well, let's take all that I know in journalism and put it into an online space. What does that look like? Twitter was getting going. Facebook was becoming somewhat respected, not what it is now, but back then. Blogs were something new. It was all this new territory. So that was interesting to me. So I decided to embrace all of that and see how I could make something work for myself at first, because I always experiment on myself, and then for clients.
Excellent. Yeah. When I moved in 2009 from Los Angeles to the DC area. And for those who are not familiar, the DC area is very well insulated from economic changes like recessions. But the folks who I spoke to in DC really didn't believe me and didn't have as much point of reference when I told them that California got hit really hard. I mean, the whole landscape of industry changed.
Right. Yeah, we saw it coming in 2008 or early 2009, and it was like, this isn't going to be a problem. This isn't going to be a problem. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Suddenly, it wasn't fine. You know, friends of mine who had longtime jobs at networks were asking me for jobs. I was still in production and doing really indie production by raising money for each project one by one by one. I had a few long-term contracts left with corporate clients and a few with networks. But as those networks consolidated, or in some cases even moved out of town to go to cheaper places with better tax breaks.
Right. I saw that. Yeah.
Wow. You know, it was shocking in a way, because things that I expected to be there forever were not there anymore. Companies went under, you know, whole production companies disappeared.
Oh, yeah.
So, wow, you know, it's like it was suddenly that kind of kick in the butt sort of situation, like change has to happen here.
And has it?
Oh, yes. Not always for the better, but yes, because what's happened is, in the old timey network structure, you had a bunch of kind of old pros, for better or worse, because they were usually white males, you know, and they were kind of running the shop. And there was such a thing as seniority and sort of a tenure, if you will, in some of these networks. Well, when the cost cutting came and when the efficiencies came of the web, there were a lot of independent people making a lot of noise who were pretty good journalists, you know, not just citizen journalists, but pretty good bloggers, pretty good columnists, pretty good video makers. Suddenly the network started to see, well, wait a minute, you know, this is, we don't need to maintain this huge infrastructure. We have all these other people out here making the noise. So now you see things like people reporting on Twitter, you know, actually using Twitter as a reporting source, which was crazy. You know, that would have been nuts in 2009. But now people do it as, you know, you see Twitter feeds coming up all the time on the news. So it's this kind of disruptive thing, which certainly brought in a lot of fresh air and a lot of new people, which in the end is good.
Right. So do you feel an atmosphere of a startup culture that's pretty strong in LA now?
Definitely. Yes. I mean, LA has changed. I came here in 88. So to write films and television, and I've seen enormous change in just the past few years. Downtown Santa Monica is completely revitalized. I'm in a brand new co-working space that wasn't here a year ago. There's a lot of energy, people starting new companies, starting new businesses. The talk in the coffee shops is of apps and networks and connections, not writing screenplays or, you know, do you have an idea for a novel or something like that? So there's some loss and some gain, you know, as always, in this sort of upheaval. There's a gain in diversity and a gain in new voices, and I think that's really the most important thing.
Love it. I'm headed there for a quick trip in July, so I'll have to look out for that.
Right. Good.
Well, how about the communications industry around all of this change? Have you seen any definitive evolutions?
Yes, definitely. in the world, say, if you call it the quote-unquote traditional world of PR, the common image we might get is an old-timey guy or gal sitting at a desk calling up some editor saying, hey, Johnny, I got a great story for you. You know, just sort of these really old kind of cigar-chompy relationships, which do exist. Believe me, those relationships are there. There are publicists who can call up someone in LA Magazine and say, I need a piece about this podcast and I'll horse trade you something else. And great, you know, we'll do that. But I find that the people who are finding the stories have shifted a lot. The people at the front lines. It used to be you'd have an assignment editor, which was usually some old-timey or aged before his time kind of guy who was listening to radio scanners and police reports and, you know, how was the information coming into this, say, TV station or magazine? Well, that's gone. You know, because the younger group of people who are now manning those or womaning those, you're humaning those, the younger group is they're looking to Google. They're watching Twitter. They're looking at Facebook. And that's how they find people to put on shows or to write articles about. And also the idea of someone having tenure at the New York Times still exists. But the idea of someone having tenure at BuzzFeed or The Verge or Vice or you name it, those people are shifting around all the time. You know, it's not like you can just lock down your database and say Johnny's going to be at the New Yorker for the rest of his life. There are people who are at the New Yorker for their whole life, but the rest of it is not like that at all. You have to really track people. So that's a data problem to be solved. That means that you really have to keep your ear to the ground. I go to Twitter first most of the time because then I can see, oh, so-and-so's left BuzzFeed, and now they're doing this. Okay, good. I'm not going to pitch them a BuzzFeed pitch. I'm going to pitch them something for something else. So I see rapid churn and change and a lot of free agentry among the writers and among the communities that I have to build. They're always shifting.
Right. That's interesting. I remember when I was in Los Angeles, there was a lot of, they weren't free agents so much as consultants. There was a huge diversity of consultants. And then there were the big agencies. And you didn't see a whole lot in between those two extremes. I'm not sure if that's sort of changing or if it's just shifted in favor of the consultants.
Yes and no. The big agencies will always exist because they always have relationships and they always will have it's kind of the big name movie star, or the big name author that they can leverage for the profile piece. So sure, that's always going to exist. But the consultants have kind of blown up because they've had to specialize more. There are PR agencies for crowdfunding campaigns. That couldn't have existed even a few years ago. There are at least three that I can think of here and probably more elsewhere. There are people like me, dozens of agencies like mine, focusing just on startups and just trying to take that sliver of business to do the startup work or the entrepreneurial sort of work. It used to be agencies would say focus on crisis management or something like that. But now we're seeing a real age of specialization and, again, kind of atomization, kind of a breakup. I think a lot of the mid-range agencies had to merge or go out of business, you know, because it's too scary. They couldn't hold their own ground. So I see that like the middle class of the agency is in trouble or gone.
I see. Yeah, it's probably harder to support that small and medium size staff.
Absolutely. And the overhead required and the sort of impressive office required. And I work in a co-working space and I ride a bicycle to work. And anybody who works with me knows that. So we're a distributed team. People come in and we actually meet and we see each other and we talk and we have office spaces, but we sit in different spots. And, you know, it's very different from the sort of agency where it's, you know, we're on the 39th floor and the receptionist greets you. It's not like that at all. Nor do I really want it to be like that. I like the flexibility of this and the low overhead of this. And I think the clients, those who don't work me are scared to death of it and run away. And those who work with me like it and we have good relationships.
That's great. Yeah, that sounds very comfortable on a variety of levels. When somebody first lands in Los Angeles or even just they say, you know what, I've decided I want to go into the communications industry. What do you like to tell them to help them get started?
I would say be ready to pivot, be ready to change, because it's always changing. Mm-hmm. Try to learn as much as you can and be prepared to be wrong. You know, I'm wrong fairly often, but I try to be wrong by myself. In other words, I try to test things on myself as much as possible, a new app or a new approach, and see if it works and see what crashes and burns or what works before I deploy it to clients. And I think clients are expecting, if you're new in the communications biz here, I think that clients have an expectation that things are going to be steady and strong, but guess what? It's not really like that. You have to change according to what the client needs and according to what's out there. So it's really a question of staying on top of things and not being afraid to be wrong, but not too often in front of the client if you can help it.
Do you have a favorite story of change in the industry?
The one that I like, which I shouldn't tell, but I'll tell anyway, is I was pitching a writer at the New York Times. And this is a classic case of people moving around and doing different things. And I had checked her out of my database, and I was pitching her this client, and she wrote back saying, "You do not want me to profile your client because I only write about dead people. I write obits, only obits." and I wrote back, you know, some stupid response like, "Well, I guess you killed that," or, you know, something dumb. But it made me realize that, you know, you really got to stay on top of this. You cannot rely on your database to be right. You have to, and even Twitter sometimes, you know, this particular person said writer for the New York Times. I thought, oh, okay, I fact checked that. But I didn't go deeply enough. So there's a lot of things like that. With things changing so quickly, it's easy to get a mismatch, especially when you're pitching or trying to build a network with someone. So I would say that I have a few like that, but that's the one that I remember.
That's great. Yeah. In sales and in pitching, a little bit of research goes really a long way.
Right. And things are going to change. You know, the people talk about needing a thick skin to be in this. And I guess that's true, but I don't really think of it that way. I've long thought of myself as the first draft guy. You know, somebody's got to put the first draft out there. And as a writer, that was always me. I was first draft guy. And people are going to take shots at that first draft because that's what a first draft is for. So in this business of communications, PR, even creative writing, someone has to do the first draft. So who's going to step up and do it? For me, it's usually going to be me.
Love that. Do you have any other tips for business owners and marketing leaders and marketers overall?
Well, I would say get comfortable with what works, but always be prepared to change, as I said. To elaborate on that a little bit, you're going to find things that work right away and things that you're just banging your head against the wall. Guess what you should do more of? You know, there's so many channels from which to choose, right? You could be the Facebook king, you could be the Twitter queen, you could be the blogger, you could be the podcaster, you could be the YouTuber, you could be the white paper person, you name it, there's a big list. Usually only a few of those things work really, really well. So recognize what works by clean metrics. Either a clean metric for me is, it feels good, I like doing this, I like podcasting, I'm going to keep doing it. That's a great metric. Or KPIs, like look at website traffic, look at Twitter followers. I've learned early on for myself that although I have a production background, I don't really like the sort of low ball YouTube video that I would have to do, like, you know, put up a white sheet and back on myself. I'm used to helicopters and steadicams and crews. So that was sort of painful to dial that back. But the minimalism of blogs and podcasts and Twitter, for example, vastly appeals to me. So I focus for myself on those things and focus the agency on those things, webinars sometimes, and not on trying to be great at Facebook because I pretty much suck at Facebook. You know, I know how to put up a baby picture and I know how to put up a cat picture. That's about where my expertise ends. Now, for clients, that's a different story because we're doing Facebook advertising and other more technical things. But when it comes down to me personally, I know what works and what doesn't. And I know with some clients, you know, I have winery clients, Facebook is just hitting it out of the park. It's perfect for them. Facebook is great. For others, Facebook is not great and it has to be something else. So for marketers, for anyone doing business, thinking about leveraging these networks, really look at what works well and don't try to be good at everything all the time.
Excellent. I don't know if I told you to bring your crystal ball or not, but yeah. I'm going to see if we can make a prediction looking into the future. Since you've seen so much change, I'd be curious to hear, what do you think the future of the industry will look like?
I think we're going to see more collaborative storytelling, which in the world of the auteur or the news person sitting behind the desk is terrifying. The idea that you would have some NBC person sitting behind a desk telling you the news, that one-way communication, we sit there passively and listen as they tell us, that's kind of going away. It started with blogs and commenting, but when you look at what's going on, say, with just Facebook and where the interaction, it's a two-way communication platform. When you look at a blog platform like Medium, which is kind of a hybridization of Facebook and Twitter and blogging, or there's a new app called Anchor, which is a micro podcast app. It's really funny. You just talk on your phone, do a 1 minute podcast, and then people comment and like.
Wow. So I hadn't heard of that. Anchor.
Yeah. Anchor. Yeah. It's a wild one. I've played around with it. It's fun. So I'm seeing all these ways where people can jump into the story and create this collaborative vision of the story. And this came, you know, there was an app called Storify, which might still be around, which was amalgamating Twitter feeds. And Twitter itself is trying to build a storytelling format. Snapchat has stories, it's trying to build a storytelling format made up of many, many parts. So I think that is a really interesting place to go. It's terrifying for someone who writes novels or wants control over the story. It's terrifying for someone who is a narrator of a traditional documentary, because now people are taking out all the parts and telling the stories into much smaller pieces. So I think that's exciting. It's also strange, because who's the authority in that? Who gets to be the editor? Who gets to be the person who says, well, this is the truth or not? And the answer is no one, maybe. And that's a little bit scary for, you know, someone who's held a job as, say, a magazine editor or a TV producer who's used to determining what we will see. That's kind of going away.
Oh, that's interesting. The timeline is more engaging now.
Yeah. It's, you know, it all goes a lot faster too. You know, things blow up and disappear. Now, I was thinking about this morning on my bike ride in. That was always the case. You know, we was kind of mourn, news used to really stick. But it didn't really. I mean, I did many, many local news broadcasts that were there and gone in half an hour. They weren't even archived. You know, something would be up on the news and it's out of there. You know, it was like Twitter, but we didn't call it that. So I think our sort of nostalgia for the longevity of news is silly. It's more like a hive mentality, which is happening. And that's frightening to people, the way information is just kind of passed around in small packets and constantly renewed and refreshed. It's more like the bazaar, you know, the marketplace of information, than someone setting up a storefront and you go in and you buy your packet of information and you leave. So it's definitely a shift for people, but I think overall will be a good one.
That is interesting. Well, it's fun to think that if the conversation is becoming more of a two-way street, then it seems that likely that action will begin to happen more quickly as well, as a next step, which is just kind of the way that logic is leading me. But that's fun to think about, mobilizing around these newly empowered conversations could be a real opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. As we've seen, you know, in political realms, and also we've seen so many times where if we question the truth, what is the truth? Well, a person sitting behind a desk talking to me is supposedly, in Walter Cronkite classic fashion, telling me the truth. But now with police brutality, with violence in campaigns, with violence against women, how many times have we seen the truth come out, the primary source of truth being someone's cell phone or some portable recording device of one kind or another, or a security cam or something like that? In other words, the truth can be told by many different sources right now, not just that voice of authority in a book or behind a desk. I think that's great. It's also pretty scary because you have to still have to validate that. There used to be an expression at NBC called first facts or early facts, which is essentially a BS way of covering yourself. Like first facts mean, well, these facts could be wrong, but we're still calling them facts. And a lot of times we are going with first facts or early facts, which is basically a dumb idea. But sometimes we don't have a choice because for those for whom it's valuable to be first, you don't really have a choice. You know, you just have to put it out there if you have to be first.
Right. It's funny calling something facts and avoiding the word that seems to be the truth, which is just speculation.
Yeah, it is speculation. Well, we're just guessing. I mean, how many times have we've seen news people look a little ridiculous saying, well, you know, essentially they're saying, well, I'm out here in front of this hurricane. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's happening next, but they put me on for 15 seconds to tell you that I don't know anything. You know, I mean, we've seen that many, many times. But of course, that's what goes on in Twitter all the time or in some other, like social media things all the time. But what happens is because it scales and there's a million people up there, somebody comes along sooner or later who knows something. And eventually the truth will out. And it's an optimistic view, but I think what happens is when you have enough sources, you do have citizen editors and you do have more people of authority show up and eventually things get sorted. But that early scrum can be a little bit of a mess for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I know I've kept you over a little bit here in our own timeline. Is there anything that you'd like to add before we start to wrap up?
You know, I'd like to add that it's a really interesting time to live in as a media maker. There are more opportunities than ever before. There are more opportunities to succeed and to fail than ever before, but it's certainly an exciting time.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Yeah, it's easy to get kind of hung up in the doom and gloom of things, but I have to agree with you. We have more opportunities than we've ever had to tell interesting, engaging stories and get it out there from new mediums to new audiences that all didn't exist just a few years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, wonderful. This has been a fun conversation, Lee. I appreciate your time. What is the best place for listeners to learn more about you and to reach you?
My website is redcupagency.com. That's like a red cup, Red Cup Agency. I'm also on Medium and Twitter as DocuGuy, like documentary guy, DocuGuy. I had to do that because there are a lot of Lee Schneiders out there. Some of, you know, do things that get them arrested. So my name is surprisingly common. So DocuGuy, that's who I am on Twitter. And there's also a Red Cup Agency Twitter account where we put up the latest stuff.
Perfect. And again, I'll get all that linked up in your show notes at spiralmarketing.com. Thanks so much, Lee. Have a great day.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.